Justine tried to read the ambassador's reaction to the jibe, but it seemed unperturbed. Spittle continued to dribble from its vocalizer gill, while its arms flopped like landed fish inside their cybernetic casings. "Your laws and their hypocrisy will always elude us," the ambassador said. "The Empire knows you always include extraordinary powers within your constitutions to impose solutions in times of crisis. We require you to invoke them now."
ANA governance will be happy to introduce a motion in the Senate," Justine said. "We will ask that Living Dream desist from reckless action."
"Will you back this by force if they refuse?"
"Unlikely," Casimir said. "Our Navy exists to protect us from external enemies."
"What is the Void Devourment, if not an enemy? Ultimately, it is everyone's enemy. The Rael acknowledge this."
"We do understand your unease, Ambassador," Justine said. "I would like to reassure you. We will work to prevent any catastrophe from engulfing the galaxy."
"The Rael could not prevent devourment. Are you greater than the Rael?"
"Probably not," she muttered. "Did it understand sarcasm?"
"Then we will prevent your ships from flying."
"Ambassador, I have to advise the Arcusan Empire against such a course of action," Casimir said. "The Navy will not permit you to attack humans."
"Do not think you can intimidate us, Admiral Casimir. We are not the helpless species you attacked at Phandola. We have allies now. I represent many powerful species who will not allow the Void to begin its final devourment phase. We do not stand alone. Do you think your Navy can defeat the whole galaxy?"
Casimir seemed unperturbed. "The Navy acts only in defense. I urge you to allow the Commonwealth to solve an internal problem in our own way. Humans will not trigger a large-scale devourment."
"We will watch you,"
the ambassador boomed.
"If you do not prevent these pilgrimage ships from being built and launched, then we and our new, powerful allies will act in self-defense."
"I do understand your concern," Justine said, "but I would ask you to trust us."
"You have never given us a reason to," the ambassador said. "I thank you for your time. I will return to my ship. I find your environment unpleasant."
Which is quite subtle for an Arcusan, Justine thought. She stood and accompanied the ambassador back to its ship. Gore materialized beside her as the hulking machine rose into the sky.
"Allies, huh? You know anything about that?" he asked Casimir.
"Not a thing," Casimir said. "They could be bluffing. Then again, if they are serious about stopping the pilgrimage, they will need allies. They certainly can't do it alone."
"Could it be the Rael?" Justine asked in surprise.
Casimir shrugged. "I doubt it. The Rael don't go sneaking around doing deals to pitch one species against another. If the Empire had approached them, I feel confident they would have told us."
"A post-physical, then?"
"Not impossible," Gore conceded. "Most of them regard us as vulgar little newcomers to an exclusive club. Those that talk to us, anyway. Most can't even be bothered to do that. But I'd be very surprised if one had. They'd probably be quite interested in observing the final devourment phase."
"How about you?" Justine inquired lightly. Gore smiled, snow-white teeth shining coldly between gold lips.
"I admit it would be a hell of a sight. From a distance. A very large distance."
"So what do you recommend?" Justine asked.
"We certainly need to start the motion in the Senate," Casimir said. "The ambassador was quite right. I don't think we can allow the pilgrimage to launch."
"Can't stop 'em," Gore said with indecent cheerfulness. "It's in the Constitution."
"We do have to find a solution," Justine said. "A political one, and quickly."
"That's my girl. Are you going to address the Senate yourself? You carry a lot of weight out there.
history in the flesh.
And it would be helpful to get confirmation from the Rael, Casimir said. You do have the personal connection.
What?
Justine's shoulders slumped.
Oh, hellfire. I wasn't planning on leaving Earth.
I expect the Hanshire ambassador would like some reassurance as well, Gore added maliciously.
Justine turned to give her father a level stare.
Yes, there's a lot of people and factions we need to keep an eye on.
I'm sure governance knows what it's doing. After all, you were its first choice. Can't beat that.
Actually, I was second.
Who was first?
Casimir asked curiously.
Tonier Gall. That bitch!
Gore spit. She couldn't get laid in a Silent World house the day after she rejuved.
Everyone hates her.
Now, Dad, history decided the resettlement period was a minor golden age.
Fucking minuscule, more like.
Justine and Casimir smiled at each other.
She was a good president, as I recall, Casimir said. Bullshit.
I'll go and visit the Hanshire Embassy on my way to the Senate, Justine said. It would be nice to know about the Empire's military movements. I'll start reassigning our observation systems inside the Empire to see if we can get a clearer picture of what's going on, Casimir said.
As Justine's body teleported out of the Tulip Mansion, Gore's primary consciousness retreated to his secure environment within the vastness of ANA. As perceptual reality locations went, it was modest. Some people had created entire universes for their own private playgrounds, setting up self-governing parameters to maintain the configurations. The bodies, or cores, or focal points they occupied within their concepts were equally varied, with abilities defined purely by the individual milieu. Quite where such domains extended to was no longer apparent. ANA had ceased to be limited to the physical machinery that had birthed it. The operational medium was now tunneled into the quantum structure of space-time around Earth, fashioning a unique province in which its manifold post-human intelligences could function. The multiple interstices propagated through quantum fields with the tenacity and fragile beauty of a nebula, an edifice forever shifting in tandem with the whims of its creators. It was no longer machine or even artificial life. It had become alive. What it might evolve into was the subject of considerable and obsessive internal debate. The factions were not openly at war over ANA's ultimate configuration, but it was a vicious battle of ideas. Gore had not been entirely truthful when he had claimed to be a conservative. He did support the idea of maintaining the status quo, but only because he felt the other, more extreme factions were being far too hasty in offering their solutions. Apart from the dividers, of course, who wanted ANA to fission into as many parts as there were factions, allowing each to go its own way. He did not agree with them, either. What he wanted was more time and more information. That way, he believed, the direction they should take would become a lot more evident. He appeared on a long beach, with a rocky headland a few hundred meters ahead of him. Perched on top was an old stone tower with crumbling walls and a white pavilion structure attached to the rear. The sun was hot on his head and hands. He was wearing a loose, short-sleeved shirt and knee-length trousers. His skin was ordinary, without any enrichments. The self-image and surroundings were taken from the early 21st century, back when life was easier, even without sentient machines. This was Hawkesbill Bay, Antigua, where he used to come with his yacht, Moonlight Madison. There had been a resort clustered along the shore in those days, but in this representation the land behind the beach was nothing more than a tangle of palm trees and lush grass, with brightly coloured parrots zipping between the branches. It did not have the wind that blew constantly through the real Caribbean either, although the sea was an astonishingly clear turquoise where fish swam close to shore. There was a simple dirt path up the headland, leading to the tower. The pavilion, with its fabric roof, covered a broad wooden deck and a small swimming pool. There was a big oval table at one end, with five heavily cushioned chairs around it. Nelson Sheldon was sitting there, a tall drink resting in front of him. In the days before ANA,
Nelson had been the security chief for the Sheldon dynasty, the largest and most powerful economic empire that had ever existed. When the original Commonwealth society and economy split apart and reconfigured as the Greater Commonwealth, the dynasty retained a great deal of its wealth and power. But things weren't the same. After Nigel Sheldon left, it lost cohesion and dispersed out among the external worlds. It was still a force to be reckoned with, politically and economically, but it lacked true clout. Over 2 centuries spent looking after the dynasty's welfare had turned Nelson into a pragmatist of the First Order. That meant he and Gore saw the whole ANA evolution outcome in more or less the same terms. Gore sat at the table and poured himself an iced tea from the pitcher.
"You accessed all that?" "Yeah, I'm interested who the Empire has as an ally, or even allies. Probably just a bluff."
"You're overestimating the Arkansans. They lack the imagination for a bluff. I'd say they've managed to dig up some ancient reactionary race with a hard-on for the good old days and a backyard full of obsolete weapons.
ANA governance is going to have to give that one some serious attention," Gore said. "We can't have alien warships invading the Commonwealth. Been there. Done that. Ain't going to let it happen twice.
It was one of the reasons we started building ANA, so that humanity is never at a technological disadvantage again. There's a lot of very nasty hardware lying around this galaxy."
"Among other things," Nelson agreed sagely, "we are going to have to give the Void some serious attention soon, just as the accelerators wanted."
"I want us to give the Void serious attention," Gore said. "We can hardly claim to be masters of cosmological theory if we can't even figure it out. It's only the analysis timescale which everyone disagrees on."
"And the method of analysis, but yes, I'll grant you that we do need to know how the damn thing is generated. It's one of the reasons I'm with you on our little conspiracy. Think of us as a very small faction." "Whatever. I stopped screwing around with semantics a long time ago. Purpose is absolute, and if you can't define it, tough. And our purpose is to undo the damage the accelerators have caused."
"To a degree, yes. The conservatives will be most active on that front. We can trust them to do a decent job. I want to try to think a couple of steps ahead. After all, we're not animals anymore. We don't just react to a situation. We're supposed to be able to see it coming. Ultimately, something has to be done about the Void problem. Understanding its internal mechanism is all very well, but it cannot be allowed to continue threatening the galaxy."
Nelson raised a glass to his lips and smiled in salute.
"Way to go, tough guy. Where the Ryell failed."
"Where the Ryell tell us they failed. We have no independent confirmation.
Nothing lasts long enough, apart from the Ryell themselves."
"Bullshit. Half the post-physicals in the galaxy have been around for a lot longer."
"Yeah, and those that were don't bother to communicate anymore. They're all quiet or dead or transcended or retro-evolved. So unless you want to go around and poke them with a big stick, the Ryell are our source. Face it, ANA is good. Great, even. We're damn nearly proto-gods. But in terms of development, we're still behind the Ryell. And they plateaued millions of years ago. The Void defeated them. They converted entire star systems into defense machines. They invaded the fucking place with an armada. And they still couldn't switch it off or kill it or blow it to hell.
They went at it the wrong way."
Nelson laughed. "And you know the right way?
We have an advantage they never did. We have insider knowledge. A mole.
The Water Walker. In Ozzy's name, tell me you're joking.
You know who paid the most attention to Inigo's dreams right at the start? The Ryell. They didn't know what was inside. They built ships which could, theoretically, withstand any quantum environment. Yet not one of them ever returned. We're the ones who showed them what's in there. It's a very small glimpse. A single city on a standard H-congruous planet. You're missing the point."
His arm swept around Hawksbill to point at the thick pillar of black rock
protruding from the water several hundred meters out to sea. Small waves broke apart on it, churning up spume. You bring any humans prior to the 25th century into here, and they'd think they were in a physical reality. But if you or I were to observe the environment through them, we'd soon realize there were artificial factors involved. The water walker gives us the same opportunity. His telepathic abilities have provided a very informative glimpse into the nature of the universe hiding inside that bastard event horizon. For all that it looks like our universe with planets and stars, it most definitely is not. This Sky Lord of the Second Dream confirms that. The void has a heart, which is most distinctive, even though we haven't been shown it yet. Knowing it's different in there doesn't give us any real advantage. Wrong. We know nothing can be achieved on a physical level. You can't use quantum busters against it. You can't send an army in to wipe out the chief villain's control room. The void is the ultimate post-physical in the galaxy, and probably all the other galaxies we can see. What we have to do is communicate with it, if we ever want to achieve any resolution to the problem it presents to our stars. I don't believe the first life ever intended it to be dangerous. They didn't know there was anything left outside that it could ever threaten. That's our window. We know humans can get inside, even though we're not sure how they did it that first time. We know there are humans in there who are attuned to its fabric. Through them, we may be able to effect change. The Water Walker is dead. He has been for millennia of internal time. Even if he were unique, which I don't believe for a minute, time is not a problem, not in here. We all know that. What we have to do is get inside and forge that tenuous little link to the heart. That's the key to this. You want to visit the void? To fly through the event horizon? Not me, much as my ego would love being the union point. There's no empirical evidence that I would have the telepathic ability inside. Even if we took ANA inside, there's no certainty it could become the conduit. No, we have to employ a method that has a greater chance of success. Nelson shook his head in dismay and a bit of disappointment. Which is? I'm working on it. It was not an auspicious start to the day. Araminta had not overslept, not exactly. She had an advancer heritage that gave her a complete set of macrocellular clusters, all functioning efficiently. She could order her secondary thought routines competently, so naturally she had woken up on time with a phantom bleeping in her ears and synchronized blue light flashing along her optic nerve. It was just after that wake-up spike that she always had difficulty. Her flat had only two rooms, a bathroom cubicle and a combi main room. That was all she could afford on her waitress's pay. Despite the fact that it was cheap, the expanded bed with its A-foam mattress was very comfortable. After the spike, she lay curled up in her cotton pajamas, cozy as a nesting frangle. Hazy morning sunlight stole around the curtains, not bright enough to be disturbing. The room maintained itself at a comfortable warmth. If she bothered to check the flat's management programs, everything was ready and waiting. The day's clothes washed and aired, a quick light breakfast in the cuisine cabinet. So I can afford to laze for a bit. The second alarm spike jerked her awake again, vanquishing the weird dream. This spike was harsher than the first, deliberately so, as it was an urgent order to get the hell up, one she never needed. When she cancelled the noise and light, she assumed she'd messed up the secondary routines, somehow switching the order of the spikes. Then she focused on the timer in her exo-images. Shit! It became a struggle to pull on her clothes while drinking the Assam tea and chewing some toast. A leisurely shower was replaced by spraying on some travel clean, which never worked the way the ads promised, leaving busy, glamorous people fresh and cleansed as they zipped between meetings and clubs. Instead, she hurried out of the flat with her mouse-brown hair badly brushed, her eyes red-rimmed and stinging slightly from the travel clean, and her skin smelling of pine bleach. Great. That should earn me some big tips, she thought grouchily as she hurried down to the big building's underground garage. Her trike pod purred its way out into Colwyn City's crowded streets and joined the morning rush of commuters. In theory, the traffic should have been light. Most people these days used regrav capsules, floating in serene comfort above the wheeled vehicles, except when they touched down on dedicated parking slots along the side of the road or on a rooftop pad. But at this early hour, the city's not so well off were all on their way to work, filling the concrete grid close to capacity with pods, cars and bikes, and jamming the public rail cabs. Araminta was half an hour late when her pod pulled up at the back of Nick's. She rushed in through the kitchen door and got filthy looks from the rest of the staff.
Sorry.
The restaurant was already full of the breakfast crowd, mid-level executives who liked their food natural, prepared by chefs rather than cuisine units, and served by humans, not bots. Tandra managed to lean in close as Araminta fastened her apron. She sniffed suspiciously and winked.
Travel clean, huh? I guess you didn't get home last night.
Araminta hung her head, wishing she did have an excuse like that.
I was up late last night. Another design course. Honey, you've got to start burning the candle at both ends. You're real young and a looker. Get yourself out there again.
I know, I will.
Araminta took a deep breath and went over to Matthew, who was so disgusted that he didn't even rebuke her. She lifted three plates from the ready counter, checked the table number, cranked her mouth open to a smile, and pushed through the doors. The breakfast session at Nick's usually lasted about 90 minutes. There wasn't a time limit, but by 8:45 the last customers were heading for the office or store. Occasionally a tourist or two would linger or a business meeting would run over time. Today there were not many lagging behind. Araminta did her penance by supervising the cleaning bots as the tables were changed, ready to serve morning coffee to shoppers and visitors. Nick's had a good position in the commercial district, 5 blocks from the docks down on the river. Tables started to fill up again after 10 o'clock. The restaurant had a curving front wall with a slim terrace running around it. Araminta went along the outside tables, adjusting the flowers in the small vases and taking orders for chocolettos and cappuccinos. It kept her out of Matthew's way. He still had not said anything to her. A bad sign. Sometime after 11, the woman appeared and started moving along the tables, talking to the customers. Araminta could see that several of them were annoyed, waving her away. Since Ethan had declared pilgrimage 10 days earlier, living dream disciples from the local fane had been coming in and pestering people. It was starting to be a problem.
"Can I help you?"
Araminta asked, keeping the tone sharp. This was a chance to earn redemption points with Matthew. The woman was dressed in a charcoal grey cashmere suit, old-fashioned but expensive, with a long flowing skirt, the kind of thing Araminta might have worn before the separation, back in the days when she had money. "We have several tables available."
"I'm collecting signature certificates,"
the woman said. She had a very determined look on her face.
"We're trying to get the council to stop ingrav capsule use above Colwyn City."
"Why?" It came out before Araminta really thought about it. The woman narrowed her eyes.
"Regrav is bad enough, but at least they're speed and altitude limited inside the city boundary. Have you ever thought what would happen if an ingrav drive failed? They fly semi-ballistic parabolas. That means they'd plummet down at half orbital velocity."
"Ah, yes. I see." She also could see Matthew giving them a wary look.
"Suppose one crashed onto a school at that speed, or a hospital. There's just no need for them. It's blatant consumerism without any form of responsibility. People are buying them only to show off. And there are studies that suggest the ingrav effect puts a strain on deep geological faults. We could have an earthquake."
Araminta was proud she did not laugh out loud.
"I see. The city traffic network wasn't designed with those sorts of speeds in mind either. The number of near-miss incidents logged is rising steadily. Will you add your certificate? Help us keep our lives safe."
A file was presented to Araminta's U-shadow.
"Yes, of course. But you'll have to order a tea or coffee. My boss is already cross with me this morning."
She flicked her gaze toward Matthew as she added her signature certificate to the petition,
confirming she was a Colwyn City resident.
Typical,
the woman grunted.
They never think of anything but themselves and their profit.
But she sat down and ordered a peppermint tea.
What's her problem? Matthew asked as Araminta collected the tea.
The universe is a bad place. She just needs to unwind a little.
She gave him a sunny smile.
Which is why we're here.
Before he could say anything else, she skipped back to the terrace. At 11:30, Araminta's yew shadow collated the morning property search it had run through the city's estate agencies and shunted the results into one of her storage lacunae. She was on her break in the little staff lounge beside the kitchen. It did not take long to review them all. She was looking for a suitable flat or even a small house somewhere in the city. There were not many that fit her criteria. Cheap, in need of renovation, near the centre. She tagged 3 agency files as possibles and checked on how the previous day's possibles were doing. 1/2 of them already had been snapped up. One really had to be quick in today's market, she reflected wistfully, and have money or at least some decent credit. A renovation was her dream project, buying a small property and refurbishing it in order to sell it at a profit. She knew she could be good at it. She had taken 5 development and design courses in the last 8 months since separating from Laurel, as well as studying every interior decorating text her U-Shadow could pull out of the Unisphere. Property development was a risky proposition, but every case she had accessed showed that the true key was dedication and hard work, as well as a lot of market research. And from her point of view, she could do it by herself. She wouldn't depend on anyone. But first, she needed money. Araminta was back in the restaurant at 12, getting the table settings ready for lunch, learning the specials the chef was working on. The anti-ingrav crusader had gone, leaving a good tip, and Matthew was treating her humanely again. Cressida walked in at 12:10. She was Araminta's cousin on her mother's side of the family, a partner in a mid-sized law firm, 123 years old and spectacularly beautiful, with flaming red hair and skin maintained to silky perfection by expensive cosmetic scales. She was wearing a 2,000 V-pound emerald and platinum toga suit. Just by walking in to Nick's, she was raising the whole tone of the place. She was also Araminta's lawyer.
Darling!
Cressida waved and came over for a big hug. Air-kissing had never been part of her style.
Well, have I got news for you, she said breathlessly. Your boss won't mind if I steal you for a second, will he?
Without bothering to check, she grabbed Araminta's hand and pulled her over to a corner table. Araminta winced as she imagined Matthew's stare drilling laser holes in her back.
What's happened?
Cressida grinned broadly, her liquid scarlet lip gloss flowing to accommodate the big stretch.
Dear old Laurel has skipped planet.
What? Araminta could not quite believe that. Laurel was her ex-husband, in a marriage that had lasted 18 utterly miserable months. Everyone in her immediate family had objected to Laurel from the moment she had met him. They had had cause. She could admit that now. She'd been 21 while he was 307. At the time, she'd thought him suave, sophisticated, rich, and her ticket out of boring, small, and small-minded agricultural Langham, a town over on the Suvorov continent, 7,000 miles away. They thought he was just another filthy punk skunk. There were enough of them kicking around the Commonwealth, especially on the relatively unsophisticated planets that made up the outer fringes of the external worlds, jaded old folks who had the money to look flawlessly adolescent, but still envied the genuinely youthful for their spirit and exuberance. Every partner they snagged was centuries younger, in a futile hope that the brio would transfer over magically. That was not quite the case with Laurel. Close, though. Her branch of the family on her father's side had a business supplying and maintaining agricultural cybernetics, an enterprise that was the largest in the county, and one in which Araminta was expected to work for at least the first 50 years of her life. After that apprenticeship, family members were considered adult and wealthy enough to take off for new pastures. A depressing number set up subsidiaries of the main business across Suvorov, leaving gaps for the latest batch of youngsters to fill, turning the cycle. It was a prospect Araminta considered so soul-crushing she would have hired out as a love slave to a prime motile to escape it. Meeting Larrell, an independent businessman with an Andrebot franchise among other successful commercial concerns, was like being discovered by Prince Charming. And given that these days an individual's age was not a physical quantity, her family's objection to the 3-century difference was so bourgeois, it certainly guaranteed the outcome of the affair. The fact that they had been more or less right about him using her only made her post-separation life worse. She could never go back to Langham now. Fortunately, Cressida was not judgmental, considering Araminta's colossal mistake as part of life's rich experience. "If you don't screw up," she had told a weeping Araminta at their first meeting, "you haven't got a base to launch your improvement from. Now, what does the separation clause in the marriage contract entitle you to?" Araminta, who had overcome a mountain of shame even to go to a family member, however distant, for legal help at the start of the divorce, had to admit theirs had been an old-fashioned wedding of the till-death-do-us-part variety. They'd even sworn that to the licensed priest in the Langham Chapel. It was all very romantic at the time. "No contract?" an amazed and horrified Cressida had asked. "Gosh, darling, you are headed for a Mount Herculaneum of improvement, aren't you?" It was a mountain that Larrell's lawyers were doing their very best to prevent her from ever setting foot on. Their countersuit had frozen Araminta's own assets, all 732 V-pounds she had in her savings account. Even Cressida, with all her firm's resources, was finding it hard to break through Larrell's legal protection, and as for his commercial activities, they had proved even more elusive to pin down. All his early talk of being the centre of a dynasty-like network of profitable companies was either a lie or a cover-up for some astonishing financial irregularities. Intriguingly, Viota's National Revenue Service had no record of his paying tax at any time in the last 100 years and was showing a healthy interest in his activities. "Skipped, departed, left this world, gone vertical, uprooted." Cressida grasped Araminta's hands and gave them a nearly painful squeeze. "He didn't even pay his lawyers." Her happiness at that eventuality was indecent, and now they're just another name on the list of 50 creditors after his heirs. Araminta's brief moment of delight suddenly darkened. "So I get nothing?" "On the contrary, his remaining solid assets, that's his townhouse and the stadium food franchise, which we did manage to freeze right at the start, are rightfully yours. Admittedly, they don't quite add up to the kind of assets that will sway a naive young girl's head." Araminta blushed furiously. "But not to be sneered at. Unfortunately, there is the question of back taxes, which I'm afraid amounts to 337,000 Vyosha pounds. And if the NRS could ever prove half of Larrell's ventures that you told me about, they'd claim the rest too, blood-sucking fiends. However, they can't prove a damn thing thanks to the excellent encryption and strange lack of records your slippery ex has muddled his life with. Then there's my fee, which is 10%, seeing as how your family, and I admire your late-found pride. So the rest is yours, clear and free." "How much?"
83,000.
Araminta could not speak. It was a fortune. Agreed, nothing like the corporate megastructure Larrell had claimed he owned and controlled, but more than she had expected and asked for in the divorce petition. Ever since she had walked into Cressida's office, she had allowed herself to dream that she might, just might, come out of this with 30,000 or 40,000, that Larrell would just pay to be rid of her.
"Oh, great Aussie. You are kidding," she whispered.
"Not a bit. A judge friend of mine has allowed us to expedite matters on account of the circumstances of the truly tragic hardship I claimed you're suffering. Your savings are now unfrozen, and will transfer Larrell's money into your account at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Congratulations. You're a free and single woman again."
Araminta was horrified that she was crying. Her hand seemed to flap about in front of her face of their own volition.
"Wow."
Cressida put her arm around Araminta's shoulders, rocking her playfully.
"How do you take bad news?"
"It's over. Really over."
"Yeah, Really? So, what say you and I go celebrate? Tell your manager where to stick his menu, go pour soup over a customer's head, then we'll hit the coolest clubs in town and drew in half the male population. How about it? Oh.
Araminta looked up, wiping tears with the back of her hand. The mention of Matthew made her realize she was supposed to be serving.
I need to get back. Lunch is really busy. They rely on me. Hey, calm down. Take a minute. Think of what's happened here.
Araminta nodded her head sheepishly, glancing around the restaurant. Her co-workers were all trying not to glance in her direction. Matthew was annoyed again.
I know, I'm sorry. It's going to take a while to sink in. I can't believe it's all over. I've got to... Oh, Ozzie, there are so many things I want to do. Great.
Let's get you out of here and bring on the serious partying. We'll start with a decent meal.
No.
Araminta could see Tandra staring anxiously and gave her a weak thumbs up in return.
I can't just walk out. That's not fair to everyone else here. They'll need to get a replacement. I'll hand in my notice properly and work the rest of the week for them.
Damn it, you are horrendously sweet. No wonder your filthy ex could take advantage so easily.
It won't happen again.
Too bloody true it won't. Cressida stood up, smiling proudly. From now on, I'm vetting anyone you date. At least come out for a drink tonight.
I really do need to go home after this and work things out. Friday night, then.
Come on. Everyone goes out Friday night.
Araminta couldn't keep the grin off her face. All right. Friday night. Thank Ozzy for that. And get yourself some serious bad girl clothes first. We're going to do this properly. Okay. Yeah, okay. I will.
She actually could feel her mood changing, like some warm liquid invading her arteries.
Where do I go for clothes like that?
Oh, I'll show you, darling. Don't you worry.
Araminta did work the lunch shift, then told Matthew she was quitting but was happy to stay on as long as he needed her. He completely surprised her by giving her a kiss and congratulating her on finally breaking free of Laryl. Tandra got all teary and affectionate, while the others gathered around to hear the news and cheer. By 3:30 in the afternoon, she had put on a light coat and walked out. The cool late spring air sobered her up, allowing her to think clearly again. Even so, she walked the route she so often walked in the afternoon, along Ware Street, take a left at the major junction, and head down the slope along Darriad Avenue. The buildings on either side were 5 or 6 stories tall, a typical mix of commercial properties. Regrav capsules slid silently overhead, and the metro track running down the centre of the avenue hummed with public cabs. The roads had few vehicles, yet Araminta still waited at the crossing for the traffic solidos to change shape and colour. She barely noticed her fellow pedestrians. The Glayfield was a bar and restaurant at the bottom of the slope, occupying 2 stories of an old wood and composite building, part of the original Planet landing camp. She made her way through the dark, deserted bar to the stairs at the back and went up to the restaurant. That, too, was virtually empty. Up at the front it boasted a sheltered balcony, where, in her opinion, the tables were too close. Waitresses would have trouble squeezing between them when they were full. She sat at one next to the rail, which gave her an excellent view along Darriad Avenue. This was where she came most afternoons to wind down after her shift at Nick's, sitting with a hot orange chocolate and watching the people and the ships. Over to her right, the avenue curved upwards into the bulk of the city, producing a wall of tall buildings, expressing the many construction phases and styles that had come and gone in Colwyn's 170-year history. To her left, the River Cairns cut through the land in a gentle northward curve, as it flowed out to the great cloud ocean 20 miles away. The river was 1/2 mile wide in the city, the top of a deep estuary that made an excellent natural harbour. Several marinas had been built on both sides, providing anchorage to thousands of private yachts, ranging from little sailing dinghies up to regrav-assisted pleasure cruisers. 2 giant bridges spanned the water, one a single unsupported arch of nanotube carbon, and the other a more traditional suspension bridge with pure white pillars of flamboyant 300 metres tall. Capsules slid along beside them, but ground traffic was almost non-existent these days, and they were used mainly by pedestrians. They led over to the exclusive districts on the South Bank, where the city's wealthier residents flocked amid long green boulevards and extensive parks. On the northern shore, barely half a mile from the Glayfield, the docks were built into the bank and out into the mudflats, 2 square miles of cargo-handling machinery and warehouses and quays and landing pads and caravan platforms. It was the hub from which the Isium continent had been developed, the second starport on the planet. There was no heavy industry on Vyosha. Major engineering systems and advanced technology were all imported. With Elezalin only 75 light-years away, Vyosha was on the fringe of the free trade zone, a market that the local population grumbled was free for Elezalin companies all right, but disadvantaged everyone else caught in its commercial web. There wasn't a wormhole linking Vyosha to Elezalin yet, but talk was that in another 100 years, when Vyosha's internal market had grown sufficiently, one would be opened, allowing the full range of cheap Elezalin products to flood through, turning them into an economic colony. In the meantime, starships from external worlds came and went. She watched them as she sipped her orange chocolate. A line of huge freighters, their metal hulls as dull as lead, heavy and ungainly, drifting down vertically out of the sky. Behind them, the departing ships rose away from the planet, brushing through Vyosha's legendary pink clouds, accelerating fast once they reached the stratosphere. Araminta gave them a mild grin, thinking of the anti-ingrav woman. If she was right, what would the starship's field effect be doing to the geology beneath the city? Maybe a simple wormhole would be the answer. She rather liked the idea, a throwback to the first Commonwealth era of genteel and elegant train travel between star systems. It was a shame that the external worlds rejected such links out of hand, but they valued their political freedom too much to risk a return to a monoculture, especially with the threat of higher culture overwhelming their hard-won independence. Araminta stayed at the table long after she usually packed up and went home. The sun began to fall, turning the clouds a genuine gold pink as the planet's hazy mesosphere diffused the dying rays of the K-class star. Transocean barges shone brightly out on the cairns, regrav engines keeping their flat hulls just above the slowly rippling water as they nosed out of the dock and headed for the open sea and the islands beyond. She always was soothed by the sight of the city, a huge edifice of human activity buzzing along efficiently, a reassurance that civilization did actually work, that nothing could kick the basics out from under her. And now, finally, she could begin to take an active part, to carve out a life for herself. The files from the property agencies floated gently through her exo-image display, allowing her to plan what she might do in more detail than she ever had bothered with before. Without money, such reviews had been pointless daydreams, but this evening they took on a comfortable solidity. Part of her was scared by the notion. If she made a mistake now, she would be back to waitressing tables for the next few decades. She had only one shot. 83,000 was a tidy sum, but it had to be made to work for her. Despite the trepidation, she was looking forward to the challenge. It marked her life's true beginning. The sun set amid a warm scarlet glow, seeming to match Araminta's mood. By then, the first customers of the evening were starting to fill up the restaurant. She left a big tip and went downstairs. Her usual routine had her walking back to Nick's, maybe doing some shopping on the way, and taking the trike pod home. But there was nothing usual about this day. There was music blasting through the bar. People were leaning on the counter, ordering drinks and aerosols. Araminta glanced down at her clothes. She was wearing a sensible skirt, navy blue, that came down below her knees, and a white top with short sleeves, made from a fabric that was specially wipe clean so that she could cope with spills. Around her, people had made an effort to smarten up for the evening. She felt slightly down-market by comparison. But then, who are they to judge me? It was a liberating thought of the kind she had not entertained since leaving Langham
back when the future was full of opportunity, at least in her imagination. Araminta sidled her way up to the bar and studied the bottles and beer taps. "Green frog, please," she told the barman. It earned her a slightly bemused smile, but he mixed it perfectly. She drank it slowly, trying not to let the smouldering mist get up her nose. Sneezing would blow away any remaining credibility. "Haven't seen anybody drink one of those for a while," a man's voice said. She turned and looked at him. He was handsome in that precise way everyone was these days, with features aligned perfectly. She guessed that meant he had been through at least a couple of rejuve treatments. Like the rest of the bar's clientele, he had dressed up, a simple grey and purple toga jacket that cloaked him in a gentle shimmer. And he's not Larrell.
"Been a while since I was let out," she retorted.
Then she smirked at her own answer, the fact she was bold enough to say it. "Can I get you another? I'm Jafel, by the way."
"Araminta. And no, not a green fog. That's a nostalgia thing for me. What's current?"
"They say Adler 88 vodka is going down in all the wrong places." She finished her green fog in a single gulp, tried not to grimace too hard, and pushed the empty glass across the bar.
"Best start there, then."
"Are you awake?" Araminta stirred when she heard the question. She wasn't awake exactly, more like dozing pleasantly, content in the afterglow of a night spent in busy lovemaking. Her mind was full of a strange vision, as if she were being chased through the dark sky by an angel. Her slight movement was enough for Jafel. His hand slid up her belly to cup her breasts.
"Oh,"
she murmured, still drowsy as the angel dwindled. Jafel rolled her onto her front, which was confusing. Then his cock was sliding up inside her again, hard and insistent. It was not a comfortable position. Each thrust pushed her face down into the soft mattress. She wriggled to try to get into a more acceptable stance, which he interpreted as full acceptance. Heated panting became shouts of joy. Araminta cooperated as best she could. The pleasure was minimal at best. Out of practice, she thought, and tried not to laugh. He wouldn't understand. At least she was doing her best to make up for lost time, though. They had coupled 3 or 4 times after going back to his place. Jafel climaxed with a happy yell. Araminta matched him. Yep, remember how to do that bit as well. 18 months with Larrell had made faking orgasms automatic. Jafel flopped onto his back and let out a long breath. He grinned at her.
Fantastic. I haven't had a night like that for a long time. If ever.
She dropped her voice a couple of octaves.
You were good.
It was so funny, as if they were reading from a script. Picked up in a bar, back to his place for a one-night stand, compliment each other, both of them playing their part of the ritual to perfection. But it has been fun.
I'm going to grab a shower, he said.
Tell the culinary unit what you want. It's got some good synthesis routines.
I'll do that.
She watched him stroll across the room and into the ensuite. Only then did she stare in curiosity. It was a chic city bachelor pad. That much was evident by the plain yet expensive furniture and contemporary art. The wall opposite the bed was a single window covered with snow-white curtains. Araminta started hunting for her clothes as the spore shower came on. Underwear. Practical rather than sexy, she acknowledged with a sigh, close to the bed. Skirt halfway between bed and door. Her white top in the living room. She pulled it on, then looked back at the bedroom. The shower was still on. Did he always take so long, or was he sticking with the part of the script that gave her a polite opportunity to exit? She shrugged and let herself out. There wasn't anything wrong with Jafel. She certainly had enjoyed herself in his bed most of the time. It was just that she couldn't think what they could say to each other over breakfast. It would have been awkward. This way she kept the memory agreeable. More practice, she told herself and smiled wickedly. And why not? This is real life again. The building had a big lobby. When she walked out into the street, she blinked against the bright pink light. It was 12 minutes until she was supposed to start the morning shift at Nick's.
Her U-shadow told her she was in the Spalding district, which was halfway across the city, so she called a taxi down. It took about 30 seconds until the yellow and purple capsule was resting a couple of centimetres above the concrete, 3 metres in front of her. She watched in bemusement as the door opened. In all her life, she'd never called a taxi herself. It had always been Larrell who ordered them. After the separation, of course, she couldn't afford them. Another blow for freedom. As soon as she arrived at Nick's, she rushed into the staff toilets. Tandra gave her a leery look when she came out, tying her apron on.
"You know, those look like the very same clothes you wore when you left yesterday."
She sniffed elaborately.
"Yep, travel clean again. Did something happen to your plumbing last night?"
"You know, I'm really going to miss you when I leave," Araminta replied, trying not to laugh.
"What's his name? How long have you been dating?"
"Nobody. I'm not dating, you know that."
"Oh, come on!"
"I need coffee."
"Not much sleep, huh?"
"I was reviewing property files, that's all." Tandra gave her a malicious sneer.
"Sweetie, I ain't never heard it called that before."
After the breakfast shift was over, Araminta ran her usual review. This time it was different. This time her U-shadow contacted the agencies, which gave her virtual tours of the 5 most promising properties, using a full-sense relay bot. On that basis, she made an appointment to visit one that afternoon. As soon as she walked through the door, she knew it was right for her. The flat was the 2nd floor of a converted 3-story house in the Philborough district. A mile and a half north of the dock and 3 blocks back from the river, with 2 bedrooms, it was perfect for someone working in the city centre on a modest salary. There was even a balcony from which one could just see the cairns if one leaned out over the railing. She went through the official survey scan with the modern analysis programmes recommended by 6 professional property development companies. It needed redecorating. The current vendor had lived there for 30 years and had not done much to it. The plumbing needed replacing. It would require new domestic units. But the structure was perfectly sound.
"I'll take it," she told the agent.
An hour negotiating with the vendor gave her a price of $58,000. More than she would have liked, but it did leave her with enough of a budget to give the place a decent refurbishment. There would not be much left over to live on, but if she completed the work within 3 or 4 months, she would not need a bank loan. It would be tough. Looking around the living room, she could see the amount of work involved. That was when she experienced a little moment of doubt.
"Come on," she told herself, "you can do this. This is what you've waited for. This is what you've earned."
She took a breath and left the flat. She needed to get back to her place and grab a shower. Travel clean could cope for only so long. Then she might get changed and go out again. There were a lot of bars in Colwyn City she had heard about and never visited. Troblum double woke in 2 of the penthouse's bedrooms. His actual self lay on a bed made from a special foam that supported his large body comfortably, providing him with a decent night's sleep. It had been Catriona's room, decorated in excessively pink fabrics and ornaments. A lot of the surfaces were fluffy, a very girly girl's room that he was now used to. His parallel sensorium was coming from a twinning link to the solido of Howard Liang, a Starflyer agent who had been part of the disinformation mission. Howard was in the penthouse's main bedroom, sharing a huge circular bed with the 3 girls. It was another aspect of the solidos that Troblum had spent years refining. Now, whenever he wanted sex, the 4 characters would launch themselves eagerly into a mini-orgy. The permutations their supple young bodies could combine into were almost endless, and they could keep going as long as Troblum wanted. He immersed himself for hours, his body drinking down the pleasure that Howard's carefully formatted neural pathways experienced, as much the puppet as the puppeteer. The 4 of them together was not, strictly speaking, a historical reality. At least, he'd never found any evidence for it. But it wasn't impossible, which sort of legitimized the extrapolation. The image and feeling of the beautiful naked bodies draped across him faded as his actual body reasserted itself, cancelling the twinning with Howard. After the shower had squirted dermal freshness spores over him,
He walked through into the vast lounge, bronze sunlight washing warmly across his tingling skin. His U-Shadow reported that there was still no message from Admiral Casimir, which he chose to interpret as good news. The delay at least meant it was still being considered. Knowing the Navy bureaucracy, he suspected that the review committee still hadn't formally met. His theory was struggling against a lot of conventional beliefs. Briefly, he considered calling the Admiral to urge him along, but his personal protocol routines advised against it. He wrapped one of his cloaks around himself, and then took the lift down to the lobby. It was only a short walk down to the Casp River, where his favorite cafe was situated on the edge of the quiet water. The building was made from white wood and sculpted to resemble a fulgale, a bird even more sedate than a terrestrial swan. His usual table underneath a wing arch was free, and he sat himself down. He gave his order to the cafe network and waited while a service bot brought him a freshly squeezed apple and gonberry juice. The chef, Rory, spent several days every week in the cafe, cooking for his enthusiastic clientele of foodies. For a culture that prided itself on its egalitarian ethos, hires could be real snobs about some traditions and crafts, and proper food was well up the list. There were several restaurants and cafes in Daroka, set up as showcases for their gastronomic patrons. Troblum had finished a dish of cereal and started on his tea when someone sat down in front of him. He looked up in annoyance. The cafe was full, but that was no excuse for rudeness. The rebuke never made it past his lips. "Hope you don't mind," Marius said as he settled into the chair, his black toga suit trailing thin wisps of darkness behind him as if he were time-lapsed. "I've heard good reports about this place." "Help yourself," Troblum said grouchily. He knew he should not show too much resentment at Marius's appearance. After all, the faction representative had channeled the kind of EMA funds to Troblum's private projects that normally were available only to huge public enterprises. It was the demands placed on him in return that he found annoying. Not the challenges themselves, they were intriguing, but the fact that they always took so much time. "Oh, you already have." The service bot delivered a second china cup for Marius. "How are you keeping, Troblum?" "Fine, as you know." His field functions detected a subtle shielding unfurling around the table, originating from Marius. Not obvious, but enough to prevent anyone from hearing or scanning what they were saying. He'd never liked the representative, and it was unusual to meet in person. An unarranged meeting was unheard of. It made Troblum worry about the reason. Something they consider very important. Marius sipped the tea.
"Excellent. Assam?"
"Something like that. Those left on Earth do take a lot of pride in maintaining their ancient heritages. I doubt they actually go out and pick the leaves themselves, though. What do you think?" "I couldn't give a fuck." "There are a lot of things that elude you, aren't there, my friend?" "What do you want?" Marius fixed his green eyes on Troblum, the faintest shiver of distaste manifesting in his expression. "Of course, bluntness to the fore. Very well. The briefing you gave to the Navy concerning the Dyson pair. What about it?" "It's an interesting theory." "It's not a theory," Troblum said in irritation. "That has to be the explanation of the origin of the Dark Fortress."
"The what?"
"Dark Fortress. It's what the Dyson Alpha Generator was originally called. I think it was Jean Duvoir who named it that first. He was on the original Second Chance exploration mission, you know. It was meant ironically, but after the war it fell out of fashion, especially with the Firewall campaign. People just didn't..."
"Troblum?"
"Yeah."
"I couldn't give a fuck.
I've got the unabridged logs from the Second Chance stored in my personal secure cube if you'd like to check."
"No, but I believe your theory."
"Oh, for Oz..." "Listen," Marius snapped. "Seriously, I believe you. It was excellently argued. Admiral Casimir thought well enough of your presentation to order a full review, and he is not easily won over. They are taking you seriously."
"Well, that's good then, isn't it?"
"In the greater scheme of things, I'm sure it is. However, you might like to consider where your comprehensive knowledge of the Dark Fortress came from."
Oh. Now Troblum was really worried. I never mentioned I was there.
I know that. The point is that we really don't want ANA governance to be aware of the detailed examination you and your team made of the Dark Fortress. Not right now. Understand?
Yes.
Troblum actually ducked his head, which was ridiculous, but he did feel contrite. Maybe he should have realized that his presentation would draw a little too much attention to him.
Do you think the Navy will review my background?
No, they have no reason to right now. You're just a physicist petitioning for EMA funds. It happens all the time, and that's the way we'd like it to remain.
Yeah, I get it.
Good. So if the review committee advises the Admiral that no further action should be taken, we'd prefer you not to kick up a fuss.
But what if they favour a proper search?
We're confident they won't.
Troblum sat back, trying to work out the politics. It was difficult for him to appreciate the motivation and psychology of other people. But if you have that much influence on the Navy, why worry?
We can't affect the Navy directly.
Not with Casimir as the safeguard. But your advisory review committee is mostly external. Some of them are sympathetic to us, as you are. Right.
Troblum could feel despair starting to cloud his mind. Will I be able to put it forward again after the pilgrimage?
We'll see. Probably yes. It was not exactly good news, but it was better than a flat refusal. And my drive project.
That can continue, providing you don't publicize what you're doing.
Maria smiled reassurance, but it didn't belong on his face. We do appreciate your help, Troblum, and we want to keep our relationship mutually beneficial. It's just that events are entering a critical stage right now.
I know.
Thank you. I'll leave you alone to enjoy your food now.
With suspicious timing, the service bot arrived as Marius departed. Troblum stared at the plate it deposited in front of him. A tower of thick buttered pancakes layered with bacon, yolk cheese, scrambled garfowl eggs, and black pudding topped with strawberries. Maple syrup and afton sauce ran down the sides like a volcanic eruption. The edges of the plate were artistically garnished with miniature hash browns, baked vine salfoods, and roasted golden tomatoes. For the first time in years, Troblum didn't feel remotely hungry.
Inigo's second dream. Edyard had been looking forward to the trip for months. Every year in late summer, the village elders organized a caravan to trek over to Witham, the closest medium-sized town in Rulan province, to trade. By tradition, all the senior apprentices went with it. This was part of their landcraft training, of which they had to have a basic knowledge before they could qualify as practitioners. They were taught how to hunt small animals, how to clear farmland ditches, which fruit to pick, how to handle a plough, and what berries and roots were poisonous, along with the basics of making camp in the wild. Even the fact that Oberon would be a travelling companion for 3 weeks had not lessened Edyard's enthusiasm. He finally was going to get out of Ashwell. Sure, he had been to all the local farms, but never farther than half a day's travel. The caravan meant he would see a lot more of Querentia, the mountains, people other than the villagers he'd lived among for 15 years, forests. It was a chance to see how others did things, explore new ideas. There was so much waiting for him out there. He was convinced it was going to be fantastic. The reality almost lived up to his expectations. Yes, Oberon was a pain, but not too much. Ever since Edyard's success with the G-Cats, the constant hassle had not ended, but it certainly had eased off. They did not speak as friends, but on the journey out, Oberon had been almost civil. Edyard suspected that was partially because of Melzar, who was the caravan master and had made it very clear before they left that he would not tolerate any trouble.
It might seem like this is some kind of holiday, Melzar told the assembled apprentices in the village hall the night before they departed. But remember, this is part of your formal education. I expect you to work hard and learn. If any of you cause me any problems, you will be sent back to Ashwell right away. If any of you slack off or do not reach what I consider a satisfactory level of landcraft, I will inform your master and you will be dropped back a year from qualification. Understood?
Yes, sir.
the apprentices muttered grudgingly. There were a lot of smirks hidden from Melzar as they filed out. They had taken 5 days to reach Witham. There were 17 apprentices and 8 adults in the caravan. 3 big carts carried goods and food. Over 30 farm beasts were driven along with them. Everyone rode G-horses. For some apprentices, it was the first time they'd ever been up on the animals. Melzar quickly assigned Ediard to help tutor them. That allowed him to open up conversations with lads who had ignored him before. After all, he was the youngest senior apprentice in Ashwell. But on the road they began to accept him as an equal, rather than the freaky boy about whom Oberon always complained. Melzar also entrusted him with controlling the G-wolves they used to keep guard. "You're better than all of us at guiding those brutes, lad," he said as they made camp the first night. "Make sure they do their job properly. Keep 3 of them with us, and I want the other 4 patrolling around outside." "Yes, sir. I can do that." It wasn't even a boast. Those were simple orders. Talk that night among the apprentices was of bandits and wild tribes, each of them doing their best to tell the most horrific stories. Alcy and Genril topped everyone with tales of the cannibal tribe that supposedly lived in the Talman Mountains. Ediard did not mention that his own parents had been killed while on a caravan, but everyone knew that anyway. He was thrown a few glances to check how he was reacting. His nonchalance earned him quiet approval. Then Melzar came over and told them all not to be so gruesome. Bandits weren't half as bad as legend had it. "They're basically nomad families, nothing more. They're not organized into gangs." "How could they be? If they were a real threat, we'd call the militia from the city and go after them. It's just a few baddens that give the rest a lousy rep. No different from us." Ediard wasn't so sure. He suspected Melzar was just trying to reassure them. But the conversation moved on, quieting as they gossiped about their guild masters. Judging by their talk, Ediard was convinced he'd gotten a saint in Akim. Oberon even claimed that Gipalt would beat the carpentry apprentices if they messed up. Witham might have been 5 times the size of Ashwell, but it had the same air of stagnation. It was set in rolling, heavily cultivated farmland, with a river running through the middle. Unusually, it had 2 churches for the lady. Ediard bit back any disappointment as they rode through the big gates. The buildings were stone or had thick timber frames supporting plaster panelling. Most of the windows were glass rather than the shutters used in Ashwell, and the streets were all stone cobble. He found out later that water was delivered into houses through buried clay pipes, and that the drains worked. They spent 2 days in the central market square, negotiating with merchants and locals, and then stocking up with supplies, such as glass, that were not made in Ashwell. The apprentices had been allowed to bring examples of their work to sell or trade. Ediard was surprised when Oberon brought out a beautifully carved box made from Martor's wood, polished to an ebony luster. Who would have thought an ass like that could create something so charming? Yet a merchant gave him 4 pounds for it. For himself, Ediard had brought along 6 G-spiders, always the trickiest of the standard genera to sculpt. They were highly valued for the dross silk they spun. And these had only just hatched. They would live for another 8 or 9 months, and during that time they would spin enough silk to make several garments or armor jackets. 3 ladies from the Weaver's Guild bid against one another for them. For the first time in his life, Ediard's farsight could not discern how eager they were when they haggled with him. They covered their emotions with steely calm, the surface of their minds as smooth as a Genistar egg. He hoped he was doing the same thing when he agreed to sell them for 5 pounds each. Surely they could sense his elation. It was more money than he'd seen in his life, let alone held in his hands. Somehow he did not manage to hang on to it for very long. The market was huge, with so many fabulous items, as well as clothes of a quality rarely found in Ashwell. He felt almost disloyal buying there, but he did need a decent full-length oilskin coat for the coming winter and found one with a quilted lining. Farther on there was a stall selling knee-high boots with sturdy silk resin soles that surely would last for years. A good investment, then. They also sold wide-brimmed leather hats.
To keep the sun off in summer and the rain in winter, the leather worker apprentice explained. She was a lovely girl and seemed genuinely eager for him to have the right hat. He dragged out the haggling as long as he dared. His fellow apprentices laughed when he returned, dressed in his new finery, but they had spent their own money too, and few had been as practical as he. That evening Melzar allowed them to visit the town's taverns unchaperoned, threatening horrifying punishments if anyone caused trouble. Ediard joined with Alcy, Genril, Janine, and Fahin. He spent the evening hoping to catch sight of the leather worker apprentice, but by the time they reached the third tavern, the town's unfamiliar ales had rendered them incapable of anything other than drinking more ale and singing. The rest of the evening was forever beyond recollection. When he woke up, slumped under one of the Ashwell carts, Ediard knew he was dying. He'd obviously been poisoned and then robbed. Too much of his remaining money was missing. He could barely stand, he couldn't eat, and he stank worse than the stables. It was also the first night he could not remember being troubled by his strange dreams. Then he found out it was a mass poisoning. All the apprentices were in the same state, and all the adults found it hilarious.
"Another lesson learned," Melzar boomed. "Well done. You all should graduate in record time at this rate."
"What a swine," Fahin grunted as Melzar walked away. He was a tall boy, so thin that he looked skeletal. As a doctor's apprentice, he'd managed to get one of the few pairs of glasses in Ashwell to help his poor vision. They were not quite right for him, magnifying his eyes to a disturbing degree for anyone standing in front of him. At some time during the night, he had lost his jacket. Now he was shivering, and not entirely from the cold morning air. Ediard had never seen him looking so pale before. Fahin was searching through the leather physics satchel that he always carried. It was full of packets of dried herbs, small phials, and rolled linen bandages. The satchel had made him the butt of many jokes in the taverns the previous night, yet he had refused to abandon it.
"Do you think they'll let us ride in the carts?"
Janine asked mournfully as she looked at the adults, who were huddled together chortling.
"I don't think I can take riding on a G-horse this morning."
"Not a chance," Ediard said.
"How much money have you got left?"
Fahin asked.
"All of you."
The apprentices began a reluctant search through their pockets. Fahin managed to gather £2 in change and hurried off to the herbalist stall. When he came back, he started brewing tea, emptying in several packets of dried leaves and adding the contents of a phial from the satchel.
"What is that?"
Alcy asked as he sniffed the kettle and stepped back, his eyes watering. Ediard could smell it too. Something like sweet tar.
"Groane, flonseed, dull bird eyes, nanamint."
Fahin squeezed some limes into the boiling water and started stirring.
"That's disgusting," Oberon exclaimed.
"It'll cure us, I promise on the lady."
"Please tell us you rub it on," Ediard said.
Fahin wiped the condensation from his glasses and poured himself a cup.
"Gulp it down in one, that's best."
He swallowed. His cheeks bulged as he grimaced. Ediard thought he was going to spew it up. The other apprentices gave the kettle a dubious look. Fahin poured the cup full again. Ediard could sense the doubt in their minds. He felt for Fahin, who was trying to do his best to help and be accepted. He put his hand out and took the cup. "One gulp."
"Yes,"
Fahin nodded.
"You're not going to,"
Janine squealed. Ediard tossed it back. A second later the taste registered, kind of what he imagined eating manure would be like.
"Oh, lady, that is... oh!"
His stomach muscles squeezed up, and he bent over, thinking he was going to be sick. A weird numbness was washing through him. He sat down as if to catch his breath after a winding blow.
"What's it like?"
Genril asked. Ediard was about to tell Fahin off something rotten.
"Actually, I can't feel anything. Still got a headache, though." "That takes longer,"
Fahin wheezed.
"Give it 15 minutes. The flon seed needs to get into your blood and circulate, and you need to drink about a pint of water to help."
"So what was the lime for?"
"It helps mask the taste."
Ediard started laughing.
It actually works?
An incredulous Alcee asked. Edyard gave him a shrug. Fahin poured another cup. It turned into a ritual. Each of the apprentices gulped down the vile brew. They pulled faces and jeered and cheered one another. Edyard quietly went to fetch a bottle of water from the market's pump. Fahin was right. It did help clear his head. After about a quarter of an hour, he was feeling okay again. Not 100%, but the brew definitely had alleviated the worst symptoms. He could even consider some kind of breakfast. Thanks, he told Fahin. The tall lad smiled in appreciation. Afterward, when they packed the carts and got the G-horses ready, the apprentices were all a lot easier around one another, and the joshing and pranks weren't as hard-edged as before. Edyard imagined that this was what it would be like from now on. They had shared together, made connections. He often envied the casual friendships between the older people in the village, the way they got on with one another. It was outings like this that saw such seeds rooting. In 100 years' time, maybe it would be he and Genril laughing at hungover apprentices. Of course, that would be a much bigger caravan, and Ashwell would be the same size as Witham by then.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.